This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Julia McFarlane, and in the early hours of Friday the 9th of May, these are our main stories. US-born Cardinal Robert Prevost has been elected as the new head of the Catholic Church. He'll be known as Pope Leo XIV. Thousands gathered in St. Peter's Square to hear his first address. We hear from our correspondents in Rome, as well as reaction from around the world. Also in this podcast, European nations celebrate 80 years since the defeat of Nazi Germany. And billionaire Bill Gates announces plans to die a poor man, giving away 99% of his fortune.
I hope I'm still alive when we finish the 20 years, but I'll save a little bit to be able to buy hamburgers as much as I need.
Even before his name was announced from the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, the crowds below were chanting Viva il Papa, Long live the Pope. The 69-year-old Robert Prevost, now Pope Leo XIV, becomes the 267th occupant of the throne of St. Peter and the new spiritual leader for 1.4 billion Catholics around the world. He is the first person from the United States to be elected Pope, though many see him just as much a cardinal of Latin America, thanks to the many years he spent as a missionary in Peru, where he later served as a bishop. The conclave has now come to an end, marked by the traditional white smoke rising above the Vatican. Our religion editor, Ali McBull, was there as it all unfolded.
The white smoke that turned a serene May evening into a moment of history and high drama. The excitement transmitting itself through the thousands who'd gathered in St. Peter's Square. Though few had predicted a result would come quite so soon. The bells of the Basilica, another sign that an as yet unnamed cardinal had been chosen to be the new Pope. From all over Rome, tens of thousands now poured into the square. Marching bands had been poised to join them. Though the focal point was the Vatican, there was a sense this was an international occasion.
May he be the best pope with all the love we're bringing him. We want a renewal, a new church, and that is what we'll have.
Well, it's a bit of stability, hopefully, for the church.
It was more than an hour after the smoke billowed from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel that the protodeacon of the College of Cardinals stepped onto the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica. I announce to you a great joy, he said in Latin.
Habemus Papam.
We have a Pope, before naming him for the first time.
Dominum Robertum Franciscum.
Cardinal Robert Prevost.
Cardinalem Prevost.
And his chosen name as Pope, Leo XIV.
Leonem Decimum Quartum.
And the crowd didn't have too much longer to wait for their first look at Pope Leo. The man from Chicago took a while to take in the magnitude of the moment, and the cheers and the chants of the crowd went on until he spoke.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
Peace be with you, he started in Italian.
Anch'io vorrei che questo saluto.
I'd like this greeting of peace to enter your hearts, he said, to all peoples, to all the earth. Peace be with you.
Aiutateci anche voi.
Very quickly, a theme of building bridges emerged. Through dialogue, through meetings, he said, we must all be one people, always in peace. And a word of thanks to his predecessor.
Grazie a Papa Francesco.
The challenges he faces within the church and as a new towering figure on a troubled global stage are great. But this was a day of celebration.
Ali McBull. Well, what do we know about the new Pope Leo XIV and how might he lead the church? Here's Mark Easton.
The presentation of a pope is a supreme moment of religious theatre. Pope Leo XIV was centre stage to tell the world, this is who I am. His predecessor, Pope Francis, in 2013, wore a plain white cassock, eschewing the traditional grandeur of the church. Leo wore a gold and pink stole. He was making a point. Who is Pope Leo XIV? Born Robert Prevost in Chicago in 1955, he became a priest in his early 20s, working for the Augustinians in the city. But his career was divided between America and Peru, where he first joined an Augustinian mission working with the poor and marginalised, and then was appointed as a bishop in the country by Pope Francis. It was Pope Francis who also brought him to the Vatican, making him a cardinal in 2023.
It's not, I think, coincidental that Pope Francis chose me. I've been a missionary my whole life, but I am American, and I think I do have some insights into the church in the United States.
Et ego Robertus Franciscus Cardinalis Prevost.
Insight is undoubtedly one of the qualities the cardinals will have valued. He has a reputation as both a deeply spiritual person, but also a practical manager. Skills that will be vital for a pope looking, as he said in his speech, to build bridges and unify. Pope Leo's in-tray is bulging with unfinished business and divisive issues. The role of women in the church. The question of gay Catholics. And how to respond to the continuing allegations and scandals of sex abuse. He himself has been accused by a survivors group in Chicago of allowing known sex abusers to remain in ministry.
Ma sempre coraggiosa di Papa Francesco che benediva Roma.
Multilingual, the Pope's speech in Italian this evening praised the courage of Pope Francis. His name, Leo, implies he knows he'll need to show courage too. The prayers of Catholics around the world will be that the universal shepherd can lead his flock to safe pasture.
Mark Easton. Pope Leo's election came as a surprise to many in the United States, the first ever North American pontiff. These nuns from the Congregation of Sisters of Mercy in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, were seen cheering and throwing their arms in the air as they watched the announcement. But it was not a surprise for former classmate of Robert Prevost, Marianne Angarola. The two attended St. Mary's School in Riverdale on the south side of Chicago, both graduating in 1969. She's been speaking to the BBC's Julian Warwicker.
He was a very committed and dedicated young man to his Catholic faith. Robert was also very intelligent. He enjoyed learning. He took it very seriously, which isn't always the case when you're in elementary school. He was a kind, gentle soul, and none of us is surprised that he's the new pope. I think he had his eyes set on that goal many, many years ago.
Really? So even at a young age around him, you were thinking he could go on to something as significant as this?
Absolutely. He was different than the rest of us. He had attained a level of spirituality at a very young age. It was in the way he cared about everybody around him. And he was comfortable setting a positive example for those around him. To know that you were raised with the same fundamentals within the same environment as the Pope is very unique. And I know what he came from. I came from the same environment. And I think it's a great lesson for so many people. If you're focused on something, why not you?
How do you think he will approach being Pope?
I don't know if he's going to take a more traditional approach or if he will be able to influence some modernization to the church, given his efforts in the missionary, helping those who are a little more impoverished. I think that there will certainly be a great influence towards, you know, helping those who actually need help. I think that there's going to be a strong influence in that regard.
And is that what you would favor in terms of his approach?
No, I think the world sorely needs that today.
Marianne Angarola speaking to Julian Warwicker. World leaders have been reacting to the election of Pope Leo XIV, with the US President Donald Trump calling it a great honour to have an American pope. The president of his adopted homeland, Peru, Dina Boluarte, said Leo's elevation to the papacy was historic.
Celebramos.
We celebrate a historic moment for Peru and the world. The election of Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost, a Peruvian by choice and heart, as Pope Leo XIV. This marks not only the first time an American ascends the throne of St. Peter, but also the first time a Peruvian, with over 20 years of service in our country, leads the Catholic Church as supreme pontiff.
French President Emmanuel Macron called it a historic moment for the Catholic Church, extending what he calls a message of fraternity. Writing on X, Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney said, "At a time of global challenges, may Pope Leo's pontificate carry forward a mission of solidarity, compassion and dignity for all." The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called on the new pope to pursue the peace efforts of his predecessor, Francis. Ukraine's President Zelensky said his country was hoping for further moral and spiritual support from the Vatican. Well, the Vatican has released the schedule for the new pope in the coming days. On Friday morning, he will celebrate Mass with the cardinals in the Sistine Chapel. Then, on Monday, the 12th of May, he's scheduled to meet members of the global media for an audience in the Paul VI Hall. Pope Francis's biographer, Austin Ivory, says that will be a crucial test for the new pontiff.
That was the moment when Pope Francis completely won everybody over. He was very, very funny from the very beginning. And so that relationship is actually pretty important. I mean, it's a moment, of course, for the Pope to thank the world's media. We've had 4,000, I believe, journalists accredited. Normally there are 500 here in the Vatican. It's a moment to tell those who are still in Rome at that time to thank them for their work. Also just a moment where we have a chance, we the media, have a chance to sort of look at him and see him, as it were, up close. But it'll be important for, again, the messages that he wants to give us.
Papal biographer Austin Ivory. Still to come.
David just is consistently pleasant, consistently humorous, and he's just very, very good company.
David Attenborough turns 99. We look back on the seven-decade career of the BBC broadcaster and world-renowned naturalist. The UK and the United States have agreed a deal which reduces tariffs on exports from both countries. This is the first agreement struck by President Trump since the policy of worldwide levies was announced last month. For the UK, the deal removes extra costs on steel and aluminium. In return, there will be concessions for a range of US products, including beef and ethanol. The UK will reportedly buy $10 billion worth of Boeing airplanes. Speaking at the Oval Office at the White House, Mr. Trump heralded it as a win for both countries.
This is now turning out, I think, really to be a great deal for both countries, because it'll be really great for the UK also. So they're opening up the country. Their country is a little closed, and we appreciate that. There won't be any red tape. Things are going to move very quickly both ways.
Benefits for the UK also include a reduced levy on cars exported to the US from 27.5% to 10%. The British Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, described it as a really important day as he spoke to workers at a car factory near Birmingham in England.
I'm really pleased to announce to you, and I wanted to come to you to announce it, that we've agreed the basis of a historic economic prosperity deal. And that is a deal that will protect British businesses and save thousands of jobs in Britain.
But is this deal as seismic as the two counterparts suggest? A question for our UK political correspondent, Rob Watson.
Not at this stage, at any rate. And President Trump is well known for being a rather great salesman. That's what he did before. But this is much more an exercise in damage limitation, certainly as far as the UK is concerned, because some tariffs have been reduced. But essentially, Britain's trading position with the United States is worse than it was a few months ago when Joe Biden was president.
So this is more about the politics for both countries, then, is that the case?
Well, politics is hugely important. I mean, I should say that the ambition is that this rather narrow agreement that's been reached would be expanded over the next year into a fuller sort of trade agreement. Whether that happens or not, whether it's advantageous to the UK, who knows? We're not at that point. But the politics is all important. To take the US first, I think President Trump was keen to indicate to the world that his policy, which many people think is pretty unconventional, of these tariffs, of a sort of bullying approach, is paying off, given the criticism domestically from many economists, from the financial markets, and from many voters to say, look, you know, I've been tough, and hey, look, I've got to deal with the UK. So that's the politics from the president's side. I mean, from the UK side, getting a deal now, it has a particular practical benefit for Mr. Starmer. There's some specific industry you mentioned where he was, the car industry, so that's good news there, some jobs saved. But it's about saying, look, my approach to Donald Trump, which many people, of course, would say was smacked a little bit of neediness and desperation, It sort of paid off. I mean, Britain has got the first deal, yes, a narrow and limited one, but hey, we've got the first deal.
And it's a well-timed optical win, isn't it, for Keir Starmer, after his Labour Party did quite badly in local elections last week?
That's exactly the point, Julia. I mean, this government has become spectacularly unpopular, spectacularly quickly, not that it was particularly loved when it was elected last July. So this is a bit of a win after those election results. But again, I think you have to put all of this in perspective. I mean, even this limited deal is not going to have much effect on the UK economy. It's thought that growth will still be pretty stagnant for the rest of this decade. And so while, yes, a bit of short-term relief for Keir Starmer, the headwinds are there.
Rob Watson. Events are taking place in many European countries to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War on the continent.
The representative of the German High Command signed the act of unconditional surrender, we may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. Today is Victory in Europe Day.
An extract of the historic speech Winston Churchill gave announcing VE Day, followed by a performance of the wartime song The White Cliffs of Dover, made famous by Vera Lynn. Both featured in a service at London's Westminster Abbey, attended by King Charles. He later gave this address in Horse Guards Parade, remembering how his mother, the late Queen Elizabeth II, celebrated VE Day.
Just 19 years old, described in her diary how she mingled anonymously in the crowds across central London. Ladies and gentlemen, I do hope your celebrations tonight are almost as joyful, although I rather doubt I shall have the energy to sing until 2 a.m., let alone, for that matter, to lead you all in a giant conga from here back to Buckingham Palace. So, in remembering the past, we must also look to the future. As the number of those who lived through the Second World War so sadly dwindles, the more it becomes our duty to carry their stories forward, to ensure their experiences are never to be forgotten.
Events to mark the end of the war in Europe have also been taking place in cities such as Berlin, Prague and Warsaw. But they were overshadowed by the continuing war in Ukraine, sparked by Russia's full-scale invasion 3 years ago. The two sides have accused each other of breaking a ceasefire, which Moscow declared to mark VE Day events there, which will be held on Friday. Our Europe editor Katja Adler sent this report from the ceremonies in Paris.
A stylish horseback parade of French Republican guards escorted President Macron's motorcade to the tomb of the unknown soldier. The tomb, with its eternal flame, nestles under the Arc de Triomphe, a traditional French rallying point to celebrate military victories. But the mood this Victory in Europe Day is somber. The war in Ukraine hangs heavily over the continent. Europe's victory against the Nazis was won thanks to the US and Russia, along with the rest of the Soviet Union. Powerful allies, then. Now, most Europeans see Russia as the biggest threat to their safety. For his VE Day celebrations in Moscow tomorrow, Vladimir Putin has invited President Xi of China to join him. Another world leader Europeans view with a sense of foreboding. But under Donald Trump, the US says Europe can't rely on Washington anymore for protection. For the first time since the Second World War. Today, as Europe rings with the sound of VE Day commemorations on parts of the continent and exchanges of fire on Ukraine's front line, this new reality hits particularly hard.
Katya Adler. Let's return to the front line, where Ukraine has called the Russian ceasefire a farce, reporting more than 700 violations in 12 hours. Russia insisted that it was observing the truce while also responding to attacks by Ukraine. Our correspondent, Yoga Dilamai, is close to the city of Pokrovsk, which Russian soldiers have been trying to seize for months.
We're in a city in eastern Ukraine, which is close to the front lines where some of the fiercest fighting has been going on in Ukraine. It's a city that's faced missile attacks in the past 2 months. This is the impact of one of them. And it also frequently faces attacks from drones. And we've come here today to find out from the residents if they've seen or heard anything different from when the ceasefire that Russia had called for was to come into effect at midnight between Wednesday and Thursday. What they have told us is that the night was quieter last night and that so far they haven't seen or heard any drones flying into the city. But from the outskirts of the city, we could hear the continuous sounds of explosions and bombardment, literally two or three explosions every minute. So it didn't sound like a ceasefire there. And we're about 20 kilometers from the closest Russian positions. And earlier today, we were at a Ukrainian artillery position. And there too, it did not sound like a ceasefire. We heard the sounds of explosions, both incoming and outgoing artillery fire. And soldiers there also told us that they did face a Russian assault overnight. Now, this was a ceasefire that had been unilaterally proposed by Russian President Vladimir Putin to coincide with the anniversary of the end of World War II, which is celebrated as Victory Day on Friday. But it was a proposal that had not been accepted by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, who's instead said that Ukraine is at any point willing to accept and implement the 30-day ceasefire that's been proposed by America, because it feels that that would be a more meaningful way forward.
Yoga Dilamai reporting from the Ukrainian front lines. The founder of Microsoft, Bill Gates, has announced that he plans to give away almost his entire fortune over the next 2 decades before closing down his foundation. He expects to donate more than $200 billion between now and 2045 to programs to eradicate diseases and alleviate poverty. Our correspondent Caroline Hawley reports.
Bill Gates, one of the world's wealthiest men, said that when he was gone, many things would be said about him. But he was determined that one of them wouldn't be. He died rich. The Gates Foundation he set up a quarter of a century ago is now a huge player in the aid world, especially in global health. But as he approaches 70 later this year, he wants to accelerate its work.
Well, I wish I had even more time, but you know, I have to say, okay, this is the last part of my life and I'm a steward of these resources. I should make sure that it's well spent.
He has ambitious plans, aiming to eradicate malaria, measles and other diseases, and to ensure no woman, baby or child dies of preventable causes. As he made the announcement, he expressed bitter anger to journalists about swingeing aid cuts in the US and the role of Donald Trump's advisor Elon Musk in them. The world's richest man was, he said, responsible for the death of its poorest children.
I think Elon hasn't been out in the field and met these USAID workers like I have. I think it's heroic work, and I think what he did over that weekend is very unfortunate, including mischaracterizing what the money was being spent on.
No philanthropic organisation could make up what he called the gulf in funding left by the aid cuts in the US, as well as the UK, France and elsewhere.
And the number of deaths will start going up for the first time. You know, we're talking about tens of millions of lives that have been saved through these partnerships, and everybody should be excited about every single death we avoid.
The challenges ahead were, he said, daunting, adding that he'd like to be around to see the money spent.
I hope I'm still alive when we finish the 20 years, but I'll save a little bit to be able to buy hamburgers as much as I need.
So almost his entire fortune, but not quite everything.
Caroline Hawley reporting. The world's most renowned naturalist, David Attenborough, marked his 99th birthday on Thursday. A towering figure in British broadcasting, David has been a defining presence on the BBC for more than 70 years. With a career that has helped shape the way generations understand the natural world, he's showing no signs of slowing down. Earlier this week, he walked the blue carpet at the premiere of his latest film, Oceans, a documentary exploring just how little we truly know about the planet's waters and how our understanding has deepened over his lifetime. Siobhan Sinnott, film and TV critic, has seen it ahead of its cinema release.
We all remember Blue Planet and Planet Earth, but this is him delivering a message about saving the world's oceans. And he's hoping that by releasing this on his 99th birthday, that this is going to impress on people how serious the need is to improve the health of the water. It gives us some extraordinary footage, also some sobering footage. I mean, it shows marine ecosystems being devastated. We see the bleaching of vital coral, just seas and seas of white, like a boneyard. But it also is a message of hope. I mean, he points to the ocean's amazing ability to recover when it's given the space to do that. But as the documentary points out, less than 3% of the ocean's fully protected. This needs to increase because, as he says, if you save the sea, you save the world. You know, as a naturalist, he has covered all manner of things. I mean, he's made us more aware of environmental messages, but also, you know, more aware of the absolute wonder of nature. I mean, he's got that incredible, iconic voice, but also his physical presence too. I remember enjoying Blue Planet 2 when he's sent out to have a look at leatherback turtles. Not only is he watching the turtles trying to make their way to the sea, but even helps one along, gives it a bit of a dunt into the ocean and says, good luck, little leatherback. And that's so typical of him, because amongst the seriousness, he could be very playful. There's another episode of Life on Earth where he goes to visit the sloths and looms up behind one and says, boo, to the sloth as he's going along. Of course, everybody loved Life on Earth when he comes face to face with the gorillas. I mean, his delight, particularly with a female gorilla who remembered him the next day and groomed and played with him that following day.
And yet, as I sit here surrounded by this trusting gorilla family, a gentle, placid creatures.
It's about showing how we connect with nature by showing how Attenborough connects with nature. I mean, it's extraordinary that this man, who was, you know, an executive at the BBC, but has made this transition from, I suppose, corporate bod to a man with an important global message about respect for the other species on our planet.
Doug Allen is a wildlife cameraman who has worked with David Attenborough across several documentaries. He says he's not just a broadcasting legend, but a colleague who is kind, funny, and always generous with his time.
You know, I've worked with well-known presenters, celebrity presenters, and I've learned that they very much have one face that they put on for the camera and another face in private when they're tired or, you know, when they're just having a bad day. David just is consistently pleasant, consistently humorous. What you see with David, what everyone expects, is David's natural persona. So he's always first to lend a hand if there's anything to get picked up. He's always, you know, obviously a wealth of stories, etc. And he's just very, very good company.
Wildlife cameraman Doug Allen on the 99th birthday of David Attenborough. And if I may, from all of us here at the BBC, a very happy birthday to David. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or any of the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service. Use the hashtag Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Peter Wise and the producer was Ella Bicknell. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Julia McFarlane. Until next time, goodbye.